duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
What's happening, Higher Side Chatters? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood. Today on the show, we're going to explore some major world events and the ways the global elite shape their narrative to get what they want. And our guest, Victor Thorne, is just the man to do that. But first, I got to say, today is a bit of a treat because it's such a rarity to have someone here in the THC studio with me. But we got Ron Patton of Paranoia Magazine sitting to my right here to navigate these weird waters and the salty conspiracy. And I couldn't be more pleased. Ron, how you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you.
We met at Conspiracy Con. Our booths were right next to each other. So we passed the time getting drunk in between sales of books and t-shirts. It was a great time over those 2 days. Then, of course, you put together Paranoia Con here a few weeks ago in San Diego, which was great. Had to be quite challenging. Were you happy with how it went, man?
It was a learning experience. And I think overall, I was really pleased, and I know the presenters enjoyed it immensely, as well as the audience. So even though the turnout was relatively small, I think, again, it was a good experience for me. And I already have a venue for next year, and it'll be in August 2014 at the Cava Lounge in San Diego.
Nice. I loved it. I thought there were a lot of great speakers. I actually thought what I saw of Lenin Honor's presentation was very interesting. He talked about 9/11, media's trauma cycles, and the male and female paradigm, how that's been warped and twisted. And we're talking about doing a THC show next month. He should be an interesting guest. His presentation was pretty good.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's so well-versed in so many different topics. The guy's a family counselor, and I think he has a very unique insight an approach to looking at the family, not like in some religious, zealous way,
right,
but just in terms of how, you know, the powers that be have sort of systematically broken the family apart in terms of the roles of people in families.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when I read his website, about a year ago, I just thought, okay, yeah. But then he gets in, you know, it's like all these tentacles that get into other aspects of conspiracy. And so actually he's going to have an article on the 9/11 fear-based media mind control in not this coming issue, but in our winter issue.
Excellent. Also, you know, Freeman talks about Disney's role in shaping that male-female paradigm in the family. If you look at most Disney movies, especially in the 90s before Pixar, you won't see very many strong female mother roles. Mm-hmm. Or if there is one, like Bambi, she's killed.
Right.
In Aladdin, Jasmine just has a dad. You know, there's a reason for that. It's because they say that the female is what holds the family together. She's the nurturer. And both the male and female children don't form correctly. There's just a warped way that they form their personalities without that motherly role. So you can take out the mother, and then it's just all aggression. You know, you find the sons are just overly aggressive. They have no nurturing tendencies at all. Females don't get the nurturing instinct. They don't know how to channel it correctly. So they're all fucked up in the head. So that's what Disney's trying to do.
Right. I wonder if they've been doing that for a long time, or if that's something just of recent vintage, because, you know, the reality is Walt Disney was a Freemason. I mean, in and of itself.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? But and then he was also a FBI informant. And so, you know, as far as propaganda is concerned, Disney has always been involved in that since the late 40s, and he had a very close relationship with J. Edgar Hoover.
Huh. Yeah, Disney was an interesting guy. But so this next year's ParanoiaCon is going to go on at the Kava Lounge. I actually went there not long ago on the recommendation to try Kava.
Uh-huh.
It's an interesting brew. It's it's got some properties, some psychoactive properties, mm-hmm. but it's pretty mild. I had never heard of it until super recently, but you go there, they put it in a coconut,
mm-hmm.
and after a couple of them, you feel kind of loose. They say it's like liquid weed in a way.
I mean, I've had the kava in a capsule, and it's just kind of mellows you out, helps you sleep and stuff, but I've never taken it in that form.
Oh, man. Well, yeah. It's going to be a party there.
Yeah, well, it's so neat. It accommodates 150 people.
Nice.
And there's a bar right there, and then there's the dance floor where we're going to set up seating, and then there's a stage, and then there's like this other room that's like sort of right above where the main floor is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking about setting up vendor tables there and then also putting a big screen TV up. So
yeah.
If people are kind of looking at books and stuff, they can still see the presenters. So I've gone there a couple of times over the past 2 weeks, and they said, hey, let's do this. And so it'll actually be in August. I made a calculated risk of, trying to do it this year, the same time they had the Comic-Con, because I was hoping to piggyback on that crowd. I failed miserably. But, again, it's a learning experience.
Right. I think it would have gone, it was just a little too far from the crowd. Had it been closer,
mm-hmm.
I think there definitely would have been some runoff, because there's all kinds of people walking around. There's all kinds of events going on down there. But
yeah.
I'm sure the rent would have been twice as much.
Oh,
too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've tried. I asked a few places, and they go, yeah, you want to pay $1,000 a day? No problem. So I opted for Cafe Sobaka, which was still a really excellent, intimate venue. And, I still might use it for a speaker or something
mm-hmm.
like that for the day. But I think next year we have to change it up, and hopefully I'm going to get a bigger draw and I'm going to have bigger names. And definitely the number one person on my list is Freeman, who's a good friend of mine.
Yeah, man, he's cool.
So, of course, Adam's going to come back, too. Adam and Joe and Andy. I told them they need to form a paranoia band. And so they're going to be working on that all year.
Nice. That's awesome. Well, before we get Victor in here, I did want to ask you about another thing we've mm-hmm. kind of talked about, but we were holding it off until we got on the air to talk about it. But you went to a peyote ceremony.
Yes.
Tell us about that, because that's like the one psychedelic I know the least about and have
mm-hmm.
not ventured to try.
I went in March, so a few months ago. A person invited me, and I was a little hesitant, but I said, what the hell? So I went, and it was for a full weekend, and it was, again, it was in Tecate at the Kumeyaay Reservation. And it's actually the same place where Carlos Castaneda did a lot of his experimentation and transcending and evolving. So it was a couple of days. They had a sweat lodge. They had dancing. And then that Saturday night is when they had the peyote ritual. There were three shamans that conducted it. And so they had the campfire and about 15 people around. And so basically it was just in powder form. And so,
weird.
He gave everybody a scoop and you drank it, water with it. And then I didn't feel anything really. And then they give you one more. It's equivalent to a gram, I think. And then all of a sudden, it started hitting, but it was weird. It wasn't like shrooms or LSD in terms of the visual aspect of it. It wasn't full-on hallucinogenic. It was more like having an awareness or a connection of people around you as well as the earth. I mean, it seemed like
Damn.
Sort of like the dirt was breathing and the tree was a lot. You could sense that things were really alive. And so as the night progressed, you could see everybody going through a different experience.
Damn, that sounds intense. How long does the drug last? I've heard it's like one of the longest running drugs, like in your system. The trip is apparently hours long.
Yeah, well, I think we started around 8 And I took 3 scoops, so that was 3 grams. Some people took 4. And yeah, it went well. I felt it well into the next morning. And the interesting thing about it too is about half the people were Americans, half of them were Mexicans. And the Americans were starting to freak out like around 3 or 4 in the morning because they were going, when is it going to be daylight? Because it seemed like 2 days, seriously. I think because your senses are so stimulated and you're so aware of your surrounding. It's like a when you're a child, how remember how time just seemed like it was so slow. And so it opens up, I think, a region of the brain which definitely affects that time continuum. And it was interesting how people were really, one woman was crying. She's going, it's never going to be daylight. Oh my God. She was kind of freaking out. But all in all, it was a great experience. And I'm going to do it again. Actually, Adam Gorightly and Andy Colvin and some other people want to do it next year, right after the ParanoiaCon. So I'm going to try to get something set up.
Damn, that would be awesome.
If you'd like.
Yeah, I would definitely partake in that. I don't see myself having a job at that point if all goes well. So, yeah, why not clear the schedule?
There you go.
All right, man. Well, it's about that time. Victor, I believe, is waiting for us. So I'm going to give him a call and keep this party going. But before I do, we're going to use my traditional segue, a plug for my conspiracy t-shirt brand, Conspiraties. Ron, you got a couple of these shirts, some hard truth on some soft cotton. Are you happy with them?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, it's interesting when I walk around and then, people walk by and they look at you and then they take a second look and they go, oh, I want to see that shirt. Hey, where'd you get that shirt? So, no, I've had several people comment on the shirt and I go, check out Conspiracy.
I appreciate that. It's I like to influence minds with the least amount of effort. That's where the stoner in me comes in, and putting it on your shirt is pretty basic. So here's a little bit more t-shirt buying motivation, and we'll see you on the other side with conspiracy connoisseur Victor Thorne.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiraties as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dress or frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiraties redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiraties.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
All right, people, Ron and I are here with a man who's been holding his magnifying glass steady over the anthill of lies spewing out from the global elite longer than I've been alive. He's the man behind the World Independent News Group, or WING, at wingtv.net, and has written numerous articles, and I counted close to 30 books on Amazon, some of which are called Conspirality, Frontman, Obama's Darkest Secrets Revealed, New World Order Assassins, and a trilogy of books on Hillary and Bill Clinton. He's here on the heels of a recent piece written for Paranoia Magazine about the Boston Marathon bombing, and I couldn't be more thrilled. Victor, welcome to the show, man.
Well, it's great to be here with you and Ron, and I look forward to this interview and also feel very privileged to be able to write for Paranoia Magazine, which I've said for I don't know how many years is the best magazine in America. So it's great to be able to be part of it.
There you go.
Thanks a lot.
Right on. Yeah, it's a real pleasure. I mean, I've been digging into your work all week, and I'm hoping we can touch on several subjects. But to start us off, the catalyst for the show really was your Boston bombing article. We just did a show 2 weeks ago with Sophia Smallstorm about Sandy Hook and the crisis actors and the idea that the event itself was more of a fiction than a reality. Do you feel the same way about the Boston Marathon bombing?
Well, not only do I feel that way, but I believe that the Sandy Hook cover-up was possibly the impetus for the Boston bombing hoax, in that, in my opinion, conspiracy researchers who have been questioning the government for decades and decades, I think we came closer with reaching critical mass with Sandy Hook than any other conspiracy before that. In other words, when you looked at the YouTube videos from Sandy Hook, and they're up in the above 10 million hits, the powers that be got worried, because they realized that once you're hitting millions and millions of people questioning the official account, that they had a problem on their hands. And the biggest problem, to summarize it, was when you go back to Sandy Hook, what did we actually see that proved the official story? What did we see with our own eyes? Did we see any dead children, dead teachers, any bloody victims, any escaped victims running from the school, any mass evacuation from the school, any gurneys being wheeled out, any bodies being loaded into ambulances, anything like that? We saw absolutely nothing other than what the media and the government told us. So I think on the heels of that is what really spawned, at least in part, the Boston bombing hoax.
I think you can even go back to the Aurora shootings, where it appeared that there was a very significant amount of, I don't know, disinformation, misinformation on the internet, as well as, just lack of surveillance videos. And so each of these traumatic events, you know, from the Aurora shootings to Sandy Hook to the Boston Marathon bombing, they seem to have the same ingredients. Wouldn't you concur?
Well, and I would also throw in there Jared Loughner out in Arizona with the alleged shooting that involved Gabby Gifford. So when you add all four of these together, it seems like a pattern. And what really differentiated Boston from Sandy Hook was that, whereas in Sandy Hook the public saw nothing, my perspective on this was that the powers that be said, all right, if you want blood and guts, we're going to give you blood and guts. And not only that, we're going to give you so much more than that. We're going to give you bombs and these amputees being pushed down the street and throwing a carjacking and this supposed midnight shootout. And the Sarnieff brothers supposedly robbed a convenience store, which later was revealed that, you know, they admitted that that never did happen. Then, of course, this all led up to this Friday night manhunt in primetime TV, where, you know, half of America was sitting on the edge of their seats watching this gunfight, and until they finally brought this, you know, the younger brother, Jokhar Tsarnaev, out of this boat where he was hiding. And it reminded me, I sat and watched it that night, and it reminded me of Wag the Dog. So that's where the title came, Wag the Dog Meets a Strategy of Tension. And that, to me, it all, both Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing seemed to me like Wag the Dog spinoffs, where one, they showed absolutely nothing. The other, they gave, you know, a better presentation than even Wag the Dog. And in that movie, Robert De Niro, he says, we're not going to have a war, we're going to have the appearance of a war. So was the Boston bombing the same thing, the appearance of some type of domestic terrorism? Yeah, I'll let that up to the listeners to decide.
Yeah, man, I actually loved that title. I recently saw Wag the Dog, and if anyone hasn't seen it recently, you got to check it. It is a phenomenal movie about manipulating the public with fake events. And even as I was watching it the other day, there's a point where they're feeling particularly bold with their false reality, and they say, hey, what's next? We should line the president up for a peace prize. And boom, you know, here we are. So I thought that analogy was a great way to reach people into understanding how the events could be faked. You know, what would it look like? Well, it would look like Wag the Dog.
Yeah, and I did the same thing. I guess it was last year I wrote a book called Conspiracy Hollywood Style, where I listed or did reviews of the top 100 conspiracy-related movies, primarily in America. And so I rewatched Wag the Dog after many years, and when I rewatched, I said, this is the blueprint. They're giving us, this is the revelation of the method. They're showing us right before our very eyes. They're saying, this is how we do it, folks. And Wag the Dog's right even up to, you know, that came out only a couple years before 9/11. And, you know, they were using the Muslim terrorists and Wag the Dog. And they're like, look, there it is. And in a short 3 or 4 years, the public doesn't even remember that in Wag the Dog, they showed us how they were going to fake this and, as you said, create a fake reality. And it's just a primo movie that everyone should watch, because I think Hollywood, even though they provide a lot of disinformation, there's also another element where they're saying, we're going to show you. We're going to show you how we do it. Right here it is. And, you know, that's what a lot of conspiracy Hollywood style was involved in, was showing how Hollywood shows their hand to the public.
Right, Victor. So is revelation of the method basically the same thing as or is it a form of predictive programming?
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. I would say Michael Hoffman, I'm not sure if he was the guy that came up with the term revelation of the method, but to boil it down into, you know, simplest terms, is he says the New World Order, if that's what we want to call them for argument's sake, that they become at some point so arrogant in their power that they say, we don't care if you realize what we're doing, because what can you do about it? So predictive programming, I would say, is more akin to the original Manchurian Candidate movie with Frank Sinatra that came out a year or so, or maybe 14, 15 months before the JFK assassination.
Right.
And that book's also included in Conspiracy Hollywood Style. And it's amazing how much predictive programming is in that movie to set the stage for the quote-unquote lone nut killer, the mind-controlled killer, and on and on. So predictive programming, I think, is an element of the revelation of the method. And the two work hand in hand, where one can lead up to something, which would be the predictive programming, while the revelation of the method, they finally say, like, okay, here it is. We've laid it out for you. What are you going to do about it now?
Yeah, you know, something funny that happened to me recently I wanted to bring up on this episode was I went to L.A. to be in an audience taping for The Price is Right. And one of the contestants that made it on was from this group who came from Boston. They were all wearing these shirts that said Boston Strong, and they were all America'd out. And I really did just think about Wag the Dog and shake my head, because it's those little nuances and added details that really cement the tragedy in the public's mind, you know? In your article, you point out a couple of these emotionally manipulative details. And they seem to be perfectly placed with a Hollywood quality to have come naturally out of a sudden and chaotic random bombing. You know, they seemed like they had to be pre-planned. Can you tell us a couple of those?
Yeah, well, these go back quite a way, as I said in the Paranoia article, all the way back to the original Gulf War back in the early 90s, where everyone remembers the yellow ribbons wrapped around the tree from the Tony Orlando and Don song. And then, of course, with 9/11, everybody had their little flags posted in their car windows and so forth. And with the Boston bombing, I guess the theme song up at Fenway Stadium in Boston is Sweet Caroline. So who but the song's originator, Neil Diamond, shows up at the stadium to sing this song.
Really?
It's this great, you know, celebration. And then Joan D'Arc told me about, because she's from... you know, she saw the hockey players up there in Boston who gave all of their jerseys to the police officers that were involved with the Boston bombing, and everyone's chanting USA, USA. So they really tap into this patriotic vein. And when there is this quote-unquote tragedy, this is the flip side of the coin then, that it makes people, you know, love their country even more, become more nationalistic. And I'm myself very nationalistic, and I love America. But there's also the ugly side of that, where people are so manipulated and exploited by these tragedies that they fall for these dupes. And you know, this type of symbolism, if you want to call that, which came straight out of Wag the Dog, was used very predominantly up in Boston.
Yeah, I think the main example you give in the article, which I did see a lot about on the internet and in the conventional media, was this amputee and the cowboy. Tell us about their roles. They seem to be like the primary actors in the initial chaos.
Right. Well, there's been a lot of debate about this subject. And in the article, I call the wheelchair man and the cowboy hat man, which was the iconic photo where this guy in the wheelchair, supposedly with his legs blown off, is being pushed down the street by this big strapping guy wearing a cowboy hat, looking like the Marlboro Man. So what could be more all-American and more iconic than this photo of this tragic victim pushed by the Marlboro Man? But nothing about the wheelchair man adds up. You know, especially when I looked at that photo the first time. And when your legs are supposedly blown off where his were, these are the biggest veins in the human body, okay? There should be blood gushing out of his legs like a fire hose. I mean, like a garden hose everywhere. But when I looked at the photo the first time, this iconic photo, there was no blood. No blood anywhere.
Right.
And there was no blood behind the wheelchair. There was no blood on the, there was no blood anywhere. And so then I looked at this so-called tourniquet, and it was basically just like a bandana kind of tied around his leg. It wasn't a real tourniquet by any, you know, way, shape, or form. And then even if this, you know, guy's legs did get blown off, the worst thing to do was to be having him sitting upright because of gravity. All the
right.
blood goes where? Downward. They would have him on a gurney with his legs pointing upward. So none of it made sense. And so the big debate over the Boston bombing revolved around, well, these people that run the world, they're sick enough that they'd actually kill people. I mean, look at 9/11. People were actually killed. Look at Oklahoma City. People were actually killed. So are you saying nobody was killed? And what the premise of my take on this is that there could have been a second bomb where people were injured, mm-hmm. but the bomb where the crisis actors were was nothing more than a flash pot where you had these actors then conveniently put in place. And why were they put in place? So that when this quote-unquote event occurred, you had the media right there, and you could ensure that you got these iconic photographs of people rolling around on a sidewalk in paint, is what it was. It wasn't blood, it was paint. And the wheelchair man with the cowboy hat and so forth. So everything was set up like Wag the Dog so that they could get these photo. It was basically a big photo op, so then these pictures could appear in newspapers all across America.
Victor, what's the ultimate motivation behind all this? I mean, considering, you know, you've done a lot of, I think, very exemplary work in researching these traumatic events. What's the motivation behind it? I always have people asking me this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, with all of these, I think that it's multifaceted when it comes to motives. That there's an array. With the Boston bombing, I would say if you boiled it down to the most important motive, was that during this Friday night manhunt for Jokhar Tsarnaev, this was primetime TV. This was as good as it gets. It was riveting. People were sitting in their living rooms watching this. And what did they see? They saw martial law in America. They saw a city or a town in complete lockdown. You had the tanks. You had 9,000 lawmen from 30 different agencies. You had the helicopters in the air. The streets blocked off. And then you had these SWAT team guys going house to house, looking and searching inside people's houses, even when a lot of the people told them they didn't have permission to do so. Okay, so they finally capture this 19-year-old kid. And as the SWAT team members, the state police, the local police, the sheriffs, and so forth are exiting this area, you have both sides of the street lined with people like it's a parade. giving them a standing ovation, waving flags, even huge flags. So what it was is, in this twisted Orwellian sense, was that America was applauding martial law.
Right.
It was
right.
Paving. This was predictive programming for the future. And one of the guys that I interviewed for this, Scott Creighton, he said the next step in line, now, because they go progressively, the next step in line is that they're going to be shooting Americans with drone missiles on American soil. So they'll ratchet it up to the next level. But right here, they got the green light. America applauded martial law that night.
Yeah, it definitely, that seems to be the goal in my eyes. I mean, aside from drawing attention away from Sandy Hook, which was a bit of a disaster, I do think you're right with the blood and guts aspect. That just fits too well. But yeah, the martial law thing at the end of that event was pretty unprecedented, you know, for just two guys, for two young kids. You need to shut down every house in the city and go door to door. Seemed a little extreme. I've never seen that in history anywhere ever.
No, this was, and like I said, I watched it live as it unfolded. And it was as good as it gets. It was fascinating TV. But afterwards, when I saw this reaction, I was literally shocked to see that this is how it had all been set up. Now, this was the coup de grace, as they say, that this was the final culmination, where if Americans have any qualms about martial law or the stormtroopers entering their houses, that night it was all dismissed. Because why? Because the government is out there to protect us against the evil terrorists. And it was amazing that I would say 90 to 95% of people watching that evening fell right into the trap, and they were sitting there applauding and saluting them too. So, you know, it worked out perfect for them.
Agreed, man. It just seems like another page out of the manufactured events playbook. But I want to switch gears a bit to another book you wrote recently called Machine Elves, Cosmic Serpents, and Quantum Magic. This seems right up the THC alley. I mean, we've talked about Terrence McKenna plenty. I'm a huge fan, which is kind of where the Machine Elves come from. But this place seems to be where conspiracy and psychedelics cross paths, judging by the title. The book's obviously deals with the psychedelic element and the quantum theory, which they seem to be kind of interlinked as well. But can you tell the people a little bit more about the content of that book? Dimethyltryptamine's involved, I'm sure.
Yeah, yes, it is. And one thing, well, I'll have to revert back a little bit, is I have I get easily bored. So I have 40-some published books. And
40,
anyone that looks
man.
At the yeah, and anyone that looks at the title of my book sees that they cover a wide array of different subjects and material. And ever since the 90s, when I started reading Paranoia magazine, that was one of my favorite, it was my favorite element to it, was that when I go to a restaurant, my favorite kind of restaurants are buffets, where you get to eat a little bit of everything instead of just having one meal. Well, that's what Paranoia has been for all these years, is they cover all of these different subjects. And one of my biggest criticisms of the conspiracy movement is that a lot of times they pigeonhole themselves. And they say, okay, well, we can look at government conspiracies, but we're not going to look at UFOs, or we're not going to look at psychedelica, or we're not going to look at mind control,
right,
or on
right.
and on. So they basically set up walls around themselves and say, this is all we're going to look at. So in this book, Machine Elves, Cosmic Serpents, and Quantum Magic, was I've had a decades-long interest in this subject, and even though I don't do drugs now, I did my fair share back in my wild days.
Yeah.
And what I did was look at the greatest ones in this field, Robert Anton Wilson and Terrence McKenna, Aleister Crowley, Dr. John Lilly. And so I put all of those out there as a basis, and then combined it with not only quantum theory, but also all of these other subjects. I brought in Carl Jung and Carlos Castaneda, and a chapter, The Secret Life of Plants, which is an amazing chapter on the consciousness that plants possess. So when you combine all of these elements, it opens up the vistas for our imagination to like unheard of levels. And when, if you just tell yourself, I'm only going to be interested in the JFK assassination and 9/11, and that's it, you know, then you're missing out on all of this other stuff. And so that was this book, and then the one that came before it, which was called Reality Bomb, were my attempts to really pay homage to these psychonauts, or, you know, these pioneers that paved the way for really a lot of what we did. Robert Anton Wilson was hugely influential in paving the way, as was William Burroughs, for what we do today. So this is my way of just thanking them and allowing people to know who these were, you know, the people that came before us.
So, Victor, do you think there's a concerted effort to suppress the use of these types of psychedelics or hallucinogenics, as far as how DMT works and how it essentially opens us up to new realities and expands our consciousness?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not the biggest expert on the law of DMT, but what I understand, it's like a federal, you know, like the federal first class federal offense to use or possess DMT. So basically what they're saying is they're going to bring the hammer down to anybody that's experimenting or allowing others to use this stuff. They're certainly trying to repress it and keep people away from it. And the big question is why? You know, why don't they want us to see these other quote-unquote realities? Well, you know, Robert Anton Wilson came up with the term consensus reality, where, in other words, the government, the church, and the state media are all basically saying, we want to create for you this version of quote-unquote reality that we want you to exist in or reside in, and we don't want you to know anything beyond that. Well, you know, in this book, I also talk about experiments that I do with self-hypnosis and scrying, and that's what the final chapter is all about, is, you know, the culmination of all these ideas, and then I experiment on myself. And, you know, I've had many, many psychic experiences through the years, and once you start learning self-hypnosis and you do this scrying exercises, that it absolutely opens up different dimensions to you. And, you know, in the past when I did LSD and other drugs, that you know, there's the doors of perception are blown open. And I think it's sad or very regrettable that people that are either afraid of this or, you know, have never done it, because if you don't blow these doors open, then in a sense you're accepting the reality that's been bestowed upon us by parents or schools or churches or governments. And to me, that's not good enough. I won't accept that.
Agreed, man. And I'm no stranger to the psychedelic method, but what about this self-hypnosis, this scaping, did you call it?
Scrying.
Scrying. What is scrying? How does one achieve that?
Well, scrying is gazing into a mirror is what it is. So what I did was that I learned this technique of self-hypnosis, where basically you create your own scripts and you read these scripts aloud and you use all these different techniques until finally you're hypnotized. And people have misperceptions about what hypnotism is. They think that it's, you know, like what we see on TV where someone's jumping around like a chicken and flapping their wings. Well, you know, that's stage hypnotism. But with real hypnotism, it's simply just a different and altered consciousness is what it is. So I first self-hypnotize myself, and then I do this scrying experiment or technique where I look into the mirror, and the things that happen are unbelievable, especially when you bring in the idea of intentionality, where in these scripts that I write for myself beforehand, I'll say, you know, what I want to try to achieve during each exercise. And once you put this element in and you guide yourself in the direction that you want to go, then amazing things happen. And I'll send you a copy of this book. If you, you know, send me your address, I'll put a copy in the mail for you. But it's an amazing process, and I'm going to start doing it again probably in September when I finish up this book I'm doing now, which is called Conspiracy Magic, and that's magic with a K. And what this book is all about is how do the powers that be, what techniques do they use on the masses to really put them under a spell or get them to accept their illusions. So it really ties in almost with this Machine Elves book in that conspiracy is really a form of magic, and that they're making people believe something that either didn't happen or doesn't exist.
So when you're gazing into the mirror for a prolonged period of time, do you look different? I mean, from a visual perspective?
Well, one of the things that happened was that, and this happened frequently on successive episodes, was that when I'm staring into the mirror, first of all, my reflection would disappear. It would absolutely disappear where I'd be looking into the mirror, and I'm gone. My reflection is gone. And then, afterward, there would be these other faces that would appear, almost like a slow-moving motion picture. And I knew that they weren't my faces because anyone that's seen me, I have a pretty distinct look, okay? Mm-hmm. And these people weren't me. I can tell you that for sure. And I was able to do some type of like automatic writing where, you know, I always have a pen and paper nearby. And so I would ask questions and I would get these answers and I would just sit there, you know, and just scribble in the darkness. You have to do this in darkness. And then afterward, I'd read, you know, the messages that were delivered to me, and it's amazing stuff. So, yeah, there were, and, you know, I'm not arrogant enough to say that I know who these faces were or who they belong to, because I don't. And, you know, going back a couple of decades, I've had, you know, a number of these experiences where, you know, communications are sent to me, and again, I won't say who they are or where they came from because I don't know. You know, I have no idea where they come from, but when they talk or when they communicate, I listen. And, you know, these were some of the most pivotal points in my life is when I got these communications. And, you know, as an example, when I was 18 years old, I was a wild, wild kid. And, you know, I was a runaway. I was gone the whole summer, kicked out of the house. And one night I woke up, or one morning after a long night, woke up, and all I had done when I was a teenage kid, I only cared about three things. I was chasing girls, partying, and driving around in fast cars. You know, that was my world. And I'd never read books. I didn't know anything about anything. Well, I woke up that next morning, and there was this sunlight that was so insanely bright, like 100 times brighter than anything I'd ever seen. And this message came down, and it said, "You're going to be a writer." And years later, and I'd never written anything in my life. I'd never even read, like, you know, 1984, or, you know, this was back in 1980. I'd never read anything. And it said, "You're going to be a writer." And it was so powerful, I said, "Okay, then I'll be a writer." You know, it's like, if it was, you know, I'm glad it didn't say I was going to be like a brain surgeon, because that doesn't really sound too appealing to me. But that's how I started writing, was via this message. So, and looking back on it now, I'm certain that this insanely bright sunlight triggered the pineal gland, and somehow I had this massive burst of DMT that allowed me to go into this different dimension and somehow gaze into a potential future, you know, not an actual future, but a potential future. And, you know, just really amazing stuff.
Damn, that is interesting. I've never really heard of that method of achieving an altered state, or channeling, or whatever it really seems to be. That's pretty wild. And it's funny you mentioned DMT and the pineal, because there's a lot of people in the conspiracy world who talk about the global elite hitting us with chemicals, mainly fluoride, with the goal of handicapping our pineal and its DMT function. I mean, have you looked into that at all? Do you see that being the case?
Yeah, well, basically, like, calcifying the pineal gland, and that to me sounds perfectly reasonable, because if this is the, you know, the ancient third eye, and this is our almost like a passageway, or a stargate, so to speak, into these different dimensions, then, you know, if this could be calcified or this could be, you know, cemented over by fluoride or whatever other means, then what it's in essence doing is saying that this escape mechanism from their consensus reality has now been blocked off from us. So I wouldn't doubt it for a second.
Yeah, it seems that the amount of energy and effort they put into suppressing psychedelics, there has to be some ulterior motive, because we know it isn't safety. They don't give a shit about our safety. It should be pretty clear. It's more about controlling the mind.
Oh, well, that's the absolute key to everything, is controlling the mind. And, you know, in this Machine Elves book, these guys I write about were brilliant, brilliant individuals. And, you know, Dr. John Lilly, who, if you would ask even, you know, 100 people in the conspiracy movement if they know who he is, I think the vast majority would shake their head and say no. He was a guy that really inspired the movie Day of the Dolphin, which was one of my favorite movies as a kid. And this guy was absolutely one of the pioneers of psychedelica in, you know, the 50s and especially the 60s. And he was going places and taking such gargantuan amounts of these substances that I'm like a Boy Scout compared to him, the stuff that he's done. And he went places that I don't even know if anyone else has ever gone since then. He was just a pioneer. And when you throw in McKenna and, you know, Robert Anton Wilson and, you know, people like Adam Gorightly now have carried forth this tradition, and, you know, especially the prankster, because not only were these guys going other places, but they were having fun while they were doing it, you know? Yeah. They were having a blast, Ken Kesey and the pranksters and all of these guys, that they didn't take themselves so god-awful seriously. And, you know, I saw a story the other day where there was this rodeo in Missouri, and one of the rodeo clowns put on an Obama face, you know, one of them rubber masks.
Yeah.
And there was such a blow-up about this that they fired the rodeo clown, and there was all kinds of backlash about it. And I was thinking, the left used to be pretty fun, you know, with Abby Hoffman and the, you know, the 68 riots out there and the Chicago 7 trial and Kesey, and they used to have fun. What happened to the left now that they're so dead serious as a heart attack and, you know, so politically correct that they're not having any fun? So I think we need to bring this prankster element back in again and, you know, have a few laughs along the way, because if we're not enjoying life, what the hell is it all worth then?
Amen, man. And yeah, that's what we try to do. Adam's great. He's a frequent co-host here on THC. I love that guy. He's fun.
Yeah, I've known Adam for many years and published his Death Cults book.
Nice.
Back in, you know, probably a going dark on 10
comedy.
Years now. Yeah, a real great book, and I've interviewed Adam many times and have quoted him quite a number. I've probably quoted Adam Gorightly more in my books than any other single writer, so that just shows, you know, how influential he's been, you know, nowadays.
Powerful. Well, you know, earlier you had mentioned even people within the conspiracy movement getting pigeonholed or pigeonholing themselves and sectioning off certain topics. You know, some shows won't talk about UFOs, some shows won't talk about DMT. And I like to pride myself on being able to talk about anything, you know? And I want to talk about another one of your books, because it seems, it's pretty interesting. And it seems like one of the biggest threads in the conspiracy world is the idea that history itself, in almost every era, has been twisted and warped to tell people the story they, the elite, want to be told. And just as you have gatekeepers in religion and science to tell us what is and isn't possible in this reality and where we come from, you know, you obviously have those gatekeepers in history too. And you wrote a book a few years back called The Holocaust Hoax Exposed. It's a bold title, and I didn't learn about it in time to read the book, but I've read as much about it as I could. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to talk about it, but there can't be anything too taboo for me or the show. I won't allow it. And I thought, really, the elites have lied and twisted everything throughout history, the Boston bombing, 9/11, even Christopher Columbus. So Nearly every world event has a slant engineered to shape our feelings and gain support for the elite's objective. So why would the Holocaust be any different? But let me have you talk about that. What did you discover about the Holocaust?
Yeah, well, I like your approach and your philosophy that nothing should be taboo, because why can we investigate the JFK assassination or Pearl Harbor or OKC, but then the Holocaust is off limits? And I know some of the big names, I won't mention any right now, but the biggest names in this field absolutely refuse to touch this one for a number of reasons that also I won't mention. But William Burroughs said, you know, quite succinctly, don't trust history. And he said this back in the 50s. So imagine now, he says, because history can be revised or altered. There are history filters when it comes to the Great Pyramids or
right.
anything like that.
Right.
So with this book, it's called The Holocaust Hoax Exposed. And from my perspective, it's the biggest conspiracy of the 20th century. So what I do in this book, it's only 170, 180 pages long, is I give this wide sweeping perspective on everything that doesn't add up. And you know, without going into a whole lot of details right now, the big question is that if we resided in Europe right now, and the three of us were doing this interview, there's a real strong possibility that all three of us could be arrested for speaking about this subject.
Really?
And you know, David Irving and a number of people that are listed in the book have all been arrested and spent time in prison for questioning or engaging in what's called revisionist history about the Holocaust. So, you know, as many problems as we have in America, one thing right now we should still cherish is that we have this ability to conduct this interview or publish books and magazines where we don't have to worry about being arrested. The same thing can't be said all around the world. So, you know, what I did in this book, and people, I strongly urge them to read it, and they can walk away from it, you know, with their own ideas, but I contend that what's known as the Holocaust was so greatly diminished from what is purported with the, you know, the sacred 6 million number, that in essence, I don't believe that the Nazis or Adolf Hitler had any extermination program intact. What they did was that, you know, Jews and many, many other Europeans, during, including Americans, died in World War II. Most of them in the work camps died from starvation, malnutrition, and disease, because the Allies had bombed out the supply lines going to these work centers. And when you have no water, no food, no medicine, and you're rampant with, you know, bugs and disease, hundreds of thousands of people die. And that's the major cause of death, was the bombings and the supply lines being cut to these work camps.
I mean, it is an interesting thing that I've never really thought about all that much. Of course, maybe probably a programmed response, but I think there's really just two main problems with criticizing the Holocaust, is what I mean to say. Firstly, it's like, you know, you don't want to be painted as a racist or insensitive to people who were taken from their homes, tattooed on their neck, you know, and put to work. I mean, that's shitty any way you slice it. But also, you know, in World War II and the Holocaust is pretty fresh. It involves so many people, almost the entire civilized world, as the term World War would imply. But there's so many pictures and personal testimonies and memoirs that it seems far-fetched that such a lie could be orchestrated without it being exposed somewhere.
Well, that's the thing, is it is being exposed in a much bigger thing in the last decade or so, when we had the personal computer revolution. And, you know, I have an entire section devoted to these memoirs that you mentioned, and dissect all of them. And a lot of the people that have written these memoirs have come out years later and admitted that what they said were lies. And some of these stories are so far-fetched that it's amazing that they weren't vetted or that they even got published in the first place. I mean, Oprah Winfrey just got burned a couple years ago on a big Holocaust book, that she and the authors had to come out and admit, you know, that it was fake, that the stuff never happened. And, you know, I guess basically, you know, I've done a lot of interviews on this subject, and just without getting into a whole lot of details, I just set it up this way, is World War II was the last real war, in that what we have now is occupations. You know, we go in and occupy Iraq, or we occupy Afghanistan, or we occupied Vietnam. But World War II was a fight to the death. This was real war to see who was going to run the world at the time. So Germany, guess what? Germany wanted to win this war. And as the war went on, in essence, every single able-bodied man from the age of 16 up to 45 or 50 years old was out in the field fighting the war. So this was a massive war machine behind them. So you have all of these factories, and you have to produce bullets and boots and tank parts and airplane parts and guns and all of these things. So how are they doing this? You know, of course there'd be some women there that could work in the factories, but when you have, you know, basically the entirety of the German male population out there, you need a lot to support this war machine. So what they did is they captured gypsies and the Allies and the Jews. And what they saw this as was free labor. So if you need to keep this war machine ramped up and you need every body you can in these factories to keep producing the bullets and the guns and the tank parts and airplane parts, what are you going to do? Are you going to kill them and waste all of these valuable resources and energy to transport them and bury and everything? Or are you going to put them into factories and have free slave labor? Well, the Germans weren't stupid. The Germans said, we want to work these people. We need them to make our bullets for us. So it was completely illogical to kill off what was free labor. It would be like back in the slavery days in America. If a plantation owner, you know, even if he hates blacks, he says, well, I need someone to pick the cotton and drag the cotton. And so what am I going to do? Either have free slave labor or kill all the slaves. Well, of course they're going to use the slaves, you know. It's, to me, the same rationale. And it goes way, way, way beyond that. But that's the simple premise of it.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, as I've been digesting this the past few days, it starts to make a little more sense. And it's odd to me that I've never really even given it much thought and just accepted the story because the narrative is so strong and it's so aggressive in one direction. But one point you made on another show was, if you just wanted to exterminate all people of a given race, why would you go to the trouble of transporting them, tattooing their necks, and shaving their heads? Like, that seems like something you'd do if you did want to keep people in a work camp, low maintenance. You know, shave their head and put a tattoo on them so you can number them all. It's definitely degrading, but the motivation probably might not have been to kill.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, even Jewish Holocaust scholars admit that there were no quote-unquote concentration camps in Germany per se. So, you know, they all had to exist outside of Germany. So considering that the Germans ran out of fuel, which is the primary reason why they lost World War II, why would the Germans expend this much energy either transporting these prisoners out of the country to Poland or Lithuania or these other places, and then, even more importantly, expend this vital resource, fuel? I mean, they had to create synthetic fuel to keep their jeeps and planes and tanks running. So when it comes to the tattoos, back in the 1940s, we didn't have nice, fancy, laminated cards with barcodes on them that could be scanned. They were workers in a work camp. They were tattooed so they could be identified. They shaved their heads because everybody had typhus. There was lice back then, and typhus was killing more people than any other disease there was. So when they got prisoners in, Jews and non-Jews alike, they shaved their heads and burned their clothes to get rid of the lice. It's just really a little bit of logic, rationale, common sense, and some arithmetic is all you need to examine this subject with fresh eyes. And you know, all I ask of people in this is to, if they get this book, go into it with open eyes. Go into it without you know, any of the propaganda associated with this subject. And you know, anyone that would buy it, and by the end of the book, if they don't believe me, send it back and I'll refund it. You know, refund their money. It's, you know, I stand by it.
So do you think Dr. Joseph Mengele was really involved in human experimentation in some of these camps, whatever you want to call them?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure that some kind of experimentation went on, sure. You know, and, you know, I didn't go into any of the other extraneous elements of World War II. So I don't even know if Mengele's name is mentioned in the book other than in one section where I examined the memoirs, where one of the female authors mentions Mengele's name. But, you know, I really took a lot of great pains to focus strictly on the Holocaust itself and nothing beyond that. So, you know, I didn't examine Mengele, but, you know, we're barbaric practices going on during World War II? Of course they were. Of course.
Right. I mean, well, the term Holocaust itself implies an extermination, you know, a genocide. And that is what you're getting at, is that that wasn't the primary motivation. I mean, we also had camps, you know, we had work camps for the Japanese and we dropped the atomic bomb. So, you know, were we much different? I mean, history is written by the winners. And with that perspective, you know, you got to keep that in mind when you're examining stuff like that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the final part of the book gives the motivations behind why this ruse was perpetrated. And, you know, again, I won't go into the details, but when you finally get to the end of the book and you understand the motives and the agenda at hand, it, to me anyway, it all clicks and makes a great deal of sense. And, you know, the best thing about this book was, I read countless books and did so much research on this subject, and most of the material is very dry, it's academic, it's technical, or it gets into the minutiae of just one tiny element of it. And so what I did was I took the best of everything and gave a wide sweeping perspective of the Holocaust and cover every subject of it. So basically what I did was, you know, years and years and years of research and put it all into a 180-page book, and it's all right there then, you know, that people can look at it and then branch off. And, you know, I've had people that wanted to disprove me, and they read the book and they would go down to their public libraries or university libraries and try to find information to refute it. And they would come back and tell me, like, I can't find anything. I can't find anything that proves this Holocaust. So, you know, so, yeah, I stand by it. And it was, to me, a major work that I thought had to be put out there.
Right on, man. Yeah, it sounds super interesting. I'm going to check it out. But, you know, Victor, we've covered a lot of ground, from the Boston bombing to DMT to the Holocaust. It's been an excellent and mind-expanding conversation. We're getting to the end of the hour. Do you want to tell people what you're working on next and, you know, where they can find you online?
Yeah, people can go to wingtv.net. That's W-I-N-G, wingtv.net. My weekly articles are at americanfreepress.net. That's the newspaper I write for. And then, of course, you know, I appear in Paranoia magazine. The latest issue is amazing, with the Boston bombing. But you know, also Adam Gorightly's article on the dead comedians.
Yeah.
And this whole issue is so chock full of everything great. So you know, anyone out there listening, if you're not a subscriber to Paranoia, or for that matter, American Free Press, what are you waiting for? Subscribe. You know, these are the last of a dying breed of real journalism and you know, just information outside of the mainstream media. So, you know, Ron's working his ass off, and we are at the paper. So support these guys, and, you know, wingtv.net is my stuff. And I'll be finishing up a book called Conspiracy Magic with the next, you know, few weeks or so, and that'll be the next one out there.
Victor, I really appreciate, you know, all your hard work and all the articles that you've written for Paranoia over the past year. And I understand you have an article coming up in the fall issue. Do you not?
Yeah, it's a little short article, but a potent one, and it's about the Dalai Lama and his ties to the CIA, and it covers one of possibly the most forgotten cover-up wars of all time, and that was the Tibetan-Chinese War back in the 1950s and into possibly the early 60s, I guess, gradually into the 60s. But, actually, Ron was the one who suggested this idea, and I, researched it and was amazed at that how little, because I would mention this to other people, and, the Dalai Lama, this Tibetan War, and they're like, what? Huh? I don't know anything about that. Huh. And it's the same thing with the article that Ron told me to look into a few issues ago about Stanley Meyer and the water car. And people were blown away by this article, and, most people didn't know about that. So this is what really, paranoia brings. And when I was talking earlier about, conspiracy researchers pigeonholing themselves, paranoia never, ever did that. And especially Ron right now, Ron's like blowing out all the windows. he's saying, we're going places where people never even heard of. And that's why, it's the best magazine in America. So subscribe, everybody.
Right on, man. Well, Victor, thanks again. It's been a real blast. No pun intended. and enjoy the rest of your day, man.
Well, thank you, and send me your address. I'll send some copies of those books out to you, and thank Absolutely. You very much for having me on your show.
Absolutely. Thanks, man. Take care.
Take care. You too. Bye-bye.
Damn, man, that was pretty heavy stuff. How'd you feel about that?
Well, it's interesting, because I've known Victor for probably over 10 years now, and when I put out my first magazine called MK Zine, which examined coercive mind control and invasive human experimentation, he was raving about that, and he was an interesting guy. And, I saw a few of his articles, and I go, But, the neat thing about Victor is to see how he's really progressed in his writing and his research. I think we all have a learning curve in terms of looking into conspiracies, and I think he's just really transcended, and he's, I think, at the pinnacle of his game right now. And he's such a prolific writer. I mean, he's putting out all these books and writing for Paranoia, American Free Press, and some other publications as well. So I really applaud him, and I just think he has a really good spirit about him as well.
Yeah, man, he was a cool guy. What's next for you, man? I assume I gathered from that you're picking up content for the new Paranoia issue. Are there any other articles in there that are going to be pretty mind-blowing?
Of course.
How could there not be?
Right. We have an article on Hollywood mind control, and you see a lot of stuff on the internet about that, like on Vigilant Citizen. This article is by Jamie Henshaw, who's, with Freeman. And it's going to blow your mind. There are other articles, other mind-blowing articles. The Secret War on Human Consciousness by Frata X. And he's a friend of Freeman's. And so I think he might be a good potential guest for your show, actually. And, of course, we just talked to Victor, and he has an article, succinct to the point. Is the Dalai Lama a CIA asset? ? And we have an article by Mac White from Texas. He's a comic illustrator, and I believe he has a radio show called PSYOP Radio, and he did one on the JFK assassination called Daily Plaza and the Dream, and sort of about his perspective on the JFK assassination since he was a little kid when it happened till now. And then we have an article called Good Vibrations. It's about the healing powers of resonance, and it's actually excerpted from the book The Resonance Key by Marie D. Jones, who you've had on your show, and Larry Flaxman. So those are just a few articles that are worth mentioning.
Excellent, man. Just a taste. So if you're interested, the new Paranoia magazine this fall. Thanks, Ron. I appreciate you coming down to my neck of the woods and coming here for a live show. It always sounds better when there's two people in the room, so I definitely appreciate that, and hopefully we can do it again sometime, man.
My pleasure.
Well, there you have it, people. Ron Patton and Victor Thorne. I'll see you next week with Neil Kramer. Once again, please check out conspiracies.net or consider making a small donation at thehiresidechats.com/donate. I'm strongly considering a breakaway from conventional life and regaining my freedom, hoping to pay the rent with THC alone. So if you're entertained, please do something to help us along. Even if it's just an iTunes review or sharing the show on your Facebook or something, it's all currency to me. So thanks again. Take it easy out there. Off the light. It's for this experimental film, which nobody knows about, and which I'm still figuring out what's going to go in my experiment. It's good.